Diabolical.
Vengeance.
Betrayal.
Bad hair.
Leaning.
Hi, everyone. This is Kimberly.
And this is Katie.
And we have a weekly podcast called A Date with Dateline, a recap of Dateline episodes. We talk about important issues like grainy surveillance footage, cell phone towers, Andrea Canning's white jeans, and Mankey's hankies. We delve into the details of any victim who's ever loved life or lit up a room.
So find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and iTunes to make A Date with Dateline.
And remember, don't watch alone.
A Date with Dateline is a podcast hosted by two professional amateur true crime TV experts with no formal training but evidence lockers filled with snark and uninformed opinions.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. The great outdoors is usually regarded as a place of serenity and peace, where nature lovers can seek refuge from our busy, bustling world. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service manages 154 national forests, spanning across 193 million acres, and hosts hikers, campers, fishermen, and climbers, just to name a few. In fact, in 2018, the Forest Service estimated that our national forests see over 150 million visitors annually. Most of us that grew up in the South, or even those that have just passed through, have spent at least some time in the Cherokee, Pisgah, or Nantahala forests that surround the Smoky Mountains. Many people have spent long camping and hiking trips inside these forests, just like fellow nature enthusiasts Meredith Emerson, John and Irene Bryant, and Cheryl Dunlap. That is, until a serial killer took advantage of these four people's love for the outdoors and ended their lives. Welcome to episode 113, Blood Mountain, the National Forest Serial Killer. On New Year's Day in 2008, 24-year-old Meredith Emerson started her day like many other days before. She rounded up her dog, a black Labrador mix named Ella, and scribbled a note on the chalkboard that she shared with her roommate, Julia Karenbauer. The note read, "Taking Ella hiking, hope you had fun," with a smiley face. Once she and Ella were in the car, the pair bounded away from their Buford, Georgia home and headed 40 miles north to Union County's Blood Mountain, located in the Chattahoochee National Forest. Julia spent the day hanging with friends. She didn't think much of it when, the next morning, Meredith wasn't at home. She assumed that Meredith had already left for work, because she did usually leave before Julia in the mornings. It wasn't until Julia realized that Ella was gone too that she became confused. It was strange for Ella to not be there. Julia usually checked on her before she left for the day. Julia called Meredith's cell phone, but it went straight to voicemail. She assured herself again that Meredith must be at work and left home to start her own day. After arriving at work, Julia received a call from a mutual friend and coworker of Meredith's. They explained that Meredith had not shown up to work and asked if Julia knew where she was. It was at that moment that Julia was sure something was wrong. She called the sheriff's department to report that her roommate had gone out hiking the previous morning and had not returned. Julia knew, based on Meredith's chalkboard note, that she had taken Ella hiking, but she hadn't included where she was hiking or when she would be home. After she alerted the police, Julia made several more calls to coordinate a search party of friends to look for Meredith. Meredith's boyfriend, Stephen Seagars, was a Gwinnett County firefighter who called in many of his colleagues to help in the search. At the time, Julia was concerned that Meredith had possibly fallen or injured herself and was stuck somewhere on a trail. The group of friends had a few ideas where Meredith might be, based on her collection of trail and hiking guides, with particular pages earmarked and highlighted. They decided to split up to search for Meredith's car at various trailheads, hoping that they could locate their missing friend. During this time, the party called park ranger stations positioned at different hiking spots and anyone else they could think of to try and figure out where Meredith might have taken Ella. Stephen, Meredith's boyfriend, finally found her car, still dusted with snow. It was parked at the base of the popular hiking spot, Blood Mountain, in a full parking lot. Blood Mountain is the sixth tallest mountain in Georgia and the highest peak on the Georgia section of the Appalachian Trail, located within the Chattahoochee National Forest. According to the sign when you enter the Blood Mountain Wilderness, in Cherokee mythology, the mountain was home to immortal spirit people called the Nunahi or Nunahi. I've actually seen it pronounced both ways. Some say this name translates into the people who live anywhere or the people who live forever. These mystical people were said to bring in lost hunters or wanderers, caring for them and letting them rest before they guided them back home. The sign also says before white settlers came to the area, the Cherokee and Creek tribes fought a bloody battle between Slaughter Gap and Blood Mountains. Many people believe Blood Mountain got its name from this battle, while others say it's because of the reddish color of lichen that grows on the mountain. Today, Blood Mountain is a popular hiking spot, despite its level of difficulty, known for its wildflowers, forest setting, and access to the Appalachian Trail. Dogs are allowed on the trail, making it an ideal spot for Meredith to take Ella. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Meredith Hope Emerson was born on June 20, 1983, in Charleston, South Carolina. She was the daughter of David Lloyd and Susan Hope Emerson and had one brother named Mark David Emerson. She was mostly raised in Holly Springs, North Carolina, a suburb of Raleigh, and moved with her family to Longmont, Colorado, where she graduated from high school. Meredith was said to be a well-loved babysitter during her time in high school, and it was in Colorado that she found a love for hiking in the Rocky Mountains. By the time she was in college, she was an experienced hiker. She moved to Athens, Georgia to attend the University of Georgia when she was 18. She majored in French and loved to travel, spending time in France during her college years. She was a member of Delta Epsilon Iota, an honor society, and the French Honor Society, and she was also an active martial arts student with a blue belt in Aikido and Judo. She graduated with honors in French and moved to Beaufort, Georgia, about a half hour from her job as a sales assistant at Process Container and Display in Winder, Georgia. Meredith had always been a dog lover and got Ella, a rescue dog, after falling in love with her when she saw her photo on an internet rescue site. She was training Ella as a physical therapy dog. As a skilled and experienced hiker, Meredith had completed more difficult hikes in the past, so her trip to Blood Mountain should have been routine. But as her friends searched the trail for Meredith and Ella and night set in, the temperature dropped steeply, and the makeshift search party grew more concerned about their missing friend. Meredith's boyfriend thought she had maybe gotten snowed in and chosen to spend the night at a nearby motel, but they didn't find that she had been registered at any of the motels they checked. The sheriff's deputies on the scene classified the situation as an overdue hiker. This changed quickly, however, when it came to the investigators' attention that a retired police officer named Seth Blankenship had reportedly recovered some alarming items while walking the trail the previous day. According to the AJC, these items included two water bottles, a leash, sunglasses, a hair barrette, and an expandable police baton. Blankenship told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that just before finding these items scattered on the trail, he had noticed a strange, toothless man walking with who he had assumed was the man's daughter. The man had been holding a police baton, which caught the retired officer's attention. But he didn't think too much of the pair until he came across the items on the ground later. Blankenship feared that something might be wrong as he noticed that the ground around the items had been disturbed. He began asking others on the trail if they had seen anything suspicious, and he found a family who had witnessed the same odd man huffing around the wooded area as if he was impatiently waiting on something. The family and Blankenship went back to the area where they had seen the man, but there was no sign of him. Blankenship explained to the AJC that he prepared his gun and continued searching for the man while the family turned in the lost items to the closest trail store. Despite all of this, as dusk came, Blankenship was unable to find the man or young woman he had seen earlier, and he left the mountain without alerting the authorities. He later told the AJC, quote, "I didn't call the police. It's horrible, but I didn't call. If I had done things different, she could be alive today." After learning about these events the next day, the Sheriff's Department requested assistance from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and Senior Agent John Cagle was assigned to the case. In an interview with NBC's Dateline, Agent Cagle described that these items raised a red flag for searchers because they were concerned that a possible struggle had taken place. The spot on the trail where the items were strewn about looked as though there had been a struggle or fight. It was then that Agent Cagle called in help from other law enforcement agencies, eventually including 19 different groups in total. Hundreds of hikers and community members from around the area flocked to the mountain to aid in the search for Meredith and Ella. So many volunteer searchers came to help that there wasn't enough area for all of them to cover. The police set up a temporary headquarters and tip line in one of the park buildings located nearby, and immediately began receiving a large number of tips from people who remembered seeing Meredith and Ella on the trail New Year's Day. Many of the tips included disturbing information about an unusual man and dog spotted with Meredith and Ella on the trail. The tipsters described the man as, quote, "strange-looking and a wiry kind of guy." The tips painted a picture of an odd drifter, a creepy, older man, with a reddish-colored dog in tow. In a press conference, law enforcement provided members of the media with the profile they had constructed based on the tips that had been called in. One officer addressed the cameras and said, quote, "It is going to be a white male between the ages of 50 and 60 years old, approximately 160 pounds. It was described as he had bad dental and a dark reddish-brown colored retriever." A photograph of a white Chevrolet Astro van in the parking lot of the Blood Mountain Trailhead, taken by another hiker the night before Meredith went missing, provided a lead on what the man might have been driving. The police issued a BOLO, or be on the lookout, for the van. This photograph, along with the description provided to the media, resulted in the biggest lead that investigators had gotten in Meredith Emerson's disappearance so far. Law enforcement received a tip from a local Atlanta businessman named John Tabor, who believed he knew the mysterious man the police were searching for. As he watched the coverage of the ongoing search and the profile of the person of interest was read, Tabor was struck by how similar the description sounded. He told Dateline that as he listened, he felt the blood drain from his face. The description shared by police fit an ex-employee of Tabor's, 61-year-old Gary Michael Hilton. Gary Hilton was born in Atlanta, Georgia on November 26, 1946. According to true crime author Fred Rosen, Hilton had a troubled childhood. His biological father was absent from his life, and at the age of 14, Hilton took a gun and shot his stepfather in the stomach. The wound did not kill his stepfather, but Hilton was institutionalized in Florida for the assault. After his release, Hilton attended high school and eventually joined the Army at the age of 18. The AJC reported that despite his problematic childhood, the now young adult had an IQ of 120 and was able to train and become a paratrooper. During his service, Hilton began to hear voices in his head. and in 1967, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia before being honorably discharged. According to several sources online, following his discharge from the Army, Hilton married his first wife in Georgia. Just 2 years later, in 1971, they divorced. Hilton spent some time in Florida for a few years before marrying two more times, but each union wouldn't last more than a couple of years before the marriage ended in divorce. Throughout his life, Hilton was arrested for various offenses, some involving drugs and weapons charges. One of those arrests, in 1995, brought Hilton into contact with a defense attorney and amateur filmmaker named Sam Rail, who was representing Hilton in a drug case. In an interview with Dateline, Rail described Gary Hilton as a con man and a sociopath. One of his arrests was because he had defrauded a charity. While representing Hilton, the two became acquainted, and Hilton began assisting Rail with the development of a new horror film titled Deadly Run. Chillingly, the plot of the movie consists of a couple of women being brought into the woods and hunted for sport. According to Rail, Hilton helped him depict how a serial killer would act and found locations to film the movie, including a cabin located in the Chattahoochee Forest, where Meredith Emerson would disappear from more than a decade after Deadly Run's release. John Tabor had employed Hilton on and off over the years, and he had known the man for over a decade. Hilton first started working for Tabor around 1997 as a telemarketer and then as an independent contractor in his siding business. Hilton had even lived in a home owned by Tabor for a short time. According to Tabor, Hilton had been a good employee for the better part of 9 years. He had always been eccentric, preferring to spend his downtime in the wilderness, drifting between national forests and the area, and camping with his dog Dandy. It was in 2007, though, that Tabor noticed an alarming change in his employees' behavior. Hilton had begun telling Tabor stories about the verbal and physical altercations he got into with other pet owners in the national forests. Tabor said that around that same time, he noticed a dramatic shift in Hilton's quality of work. He recalled that one day, after finding out that Hilton had not been doing his job, he came across the man appearing less put together than usual. Even stranger, he realized that Hilton was suddenly missing several teeth. Gary Hilton explained to Tabor that he had pulled the teeth out with a pair of pliers. He told his boss that he enjoyed doing it because it frightened people. After this disturbing encounter, Tabor made the decision to fire Hilton. After he let him go, Tabor said he was afraid of Hilton and bought two guns for protection and drove a rented car for a while. Tabor explained to the investigators working the case that the connection between their profile and the scene of Meredith's disappearance was too uncanny to be a coincidence. He explained in an interview with Dateline that, quote, "The first thing that really got my attention was where the event happened, where she went missing, Blood Mountain. I knew that was a place he liked to hang out and that he had a dog with him. And most importantly, was the evidence they had found at the scene. I knew Hilton had always had an expandable police baton with him." This tip from Tabor allowed police to pull up a driver's license record for the ex-employee. They showed his picture to hikers who had reported seeing the man with Meredith and confirmed that Gary Michael Hilton was now their person of interest. Meredith's parents, Susan and David Emerson, flew in from Colorado to join the search. Their family friend, Peggy Bailey, was the family's spokesperson. In a press conference with the local media, Bailey said, quote, "Let me tell you something. Meredith Emerson can do anything. She is feisty. She is strong. She is tiny and petite, 120 pounds. But let me tell you, I have every hope that if anybody could survive, she could run these mountains. She's a strong person. If anybody could survive, she can." Now that they had a person of interest and suspected foul play in Meredith's disappearance, Bailey also made a direct appeal to Hilton. She looked at the cameras and stated, quote, "I hope he realizes that this would be helpful, that his heart would be softened and turned to coming forward with information. So please, please have the courage to come forward We need you. 3 days into Meredith's disappearance, Hilton's picture and information circulated throughout every news station and cycle across Georgia and the surrounding areas. Surprisingly enough, Hilton called his old boss asking for a favor. He acted as though nothing was wrong, John Tabor said. Hilton apologized at length for his past bad behavior, explaining that he had been ill then, but he had since gotten better and was ready to get back to work for Tabor. Incredibly, Tabor did not inform police about this call until 2 hours later. When he did, police were still able to trace the call, learning that it was made at a huddle house 50 miles from where investigators believed Meredith had been abducted. But by then, Hilton had disappeared. While on the phone, Tabor, in an effort to lure Hilton into a specific location so that he could be apprehended by police, said he would write Hilton a check for $800 and leave it for him to pick up at his old residence, the building that Tabor owned. Police staked out the drop-off location in wait for Hilton, but unfortunately, he never showed up to pick up the bait. Investigators working the case were provided with surveillance photos of Gary Hilton attempting to use Meredith's ATM card 15 miles away from her presumed abduction site. A second attempt was made 50 miles south of Blood Mountain and again 80 miles away from the site. None of these efforts were successful. Hilton never got any money from the ATMs. This suggested to law enforcement that Hilton did not have the correct account information, and they hoped that it was Meredith providing him with the incorrect PIN number, a sign that she might still be alive. Along with the surveillance photos of Hilton, investigators got another big tip. A woman called the tip line to report that she had seen a black lab circling the parking lot of a local supermarket. After getting a closer look, the woman was convinced that the dog might have been Meredith's beloved rescue dog. She took the lab to a vet, where they were able to read the identity chip implanted in the dog. The vet confirmed that the dog was in fact Ella. Another tip came in from a female acquaintance of Hilton's. He had reportedly called the woman to ask for money, to which she responded with, "Don't you know the whole world is looking for you?" She said Hilton abruptly hung up. The call came from a payphone at a convenience store near the same supermarket where Ella was found. Knowing that Hilton had just been in the proximity of the supermarket where Ella was, police searched dumpsters in the surrounding area. In one of these dumpsters, investigators found Meredith's purse and wallet with her identification cards and a trash bag containing 3 bloody fleece tops. Not far from the supermarket, more tips were called in about a suspicious man in a white van matching Hilton's description. A 911 call was made by a man who said he was positive that he was witnessing Hilton clean out his van. In the call, the man explains that Hilton was wearing a green sweatshirt and had a reddish dog with him. The caller said Hilton was removing items, including a blanket, sleeping bag, and bags of trash from his van at the Chevron gas station. The caller, anxious for police to arrive before Hilton left the gas station, said, quote, "I can go take him down if you want," to which the 911 operator replied, "No, sir, stay right there." And right at that moment, police pulled up to the scene. The responding officers apprehended Hilton and took him in for questioning, where he refused to speak and requested a lawyer. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. I love to cook. It's my zen time. I catch up on podcasts and zone out. That's why I'm so excited about our new partner, GreenPan. Since 2007, millions of people around the world have joined the GreenPan revolution. GreenPan's founders discovered that traditional nonstick pans were made with plastic coatings that can turn toxic with heat. So they set out to make a new alternative. GreenPan invented the ceramic nonstick cookware category and are pioneers in creating cookware without harmful toxins like cadmium and lead. bed. Ceramic does not emit fumes when it's cooked. It conducts heat evenly and is super easy to clean. It also takes much less oil or butter, so your meals are healthier. Greenpan also has scratch guard reinforced surface technology, a double exterior with an oven safe handle, and it's good for the environment. Greenpan emits 60% less CO2 during the production process at their solar powered factory. They have full sets, frying pans, grill pans, woks, pots, and accessories with tons of different collections to choose from. And their site has a huge number of great recipes as well. We just got our Greenpan Reserve open fry pan set, and I have to say, I can already see a huge difference. I love the design and colors, as well as the peace of mind knowing I'm not cooking with harmful chemicals. And with less oil and sticking, it just cooks my food better. Remember, healthy cooking is more than about just the food you cook. It's also the products you cook with, too. Right now, they have an exclusive offer just for Southern Fried listeners. If you go to greenpan.us and use the promo code Southern Fried, you'll receive 30% off your entire order plus free shipping on orders over $50. Whether you buy one pan or a whole set, that's 30% off. So go to greenpan.us and use our promo code Southern Fried. What guilty pleasures have you guys been into lately? I loved the Bridgerton series on Netflix and started devouring the books the show is based on. The books are a really fun read, but page-turners that can be such a time suck. I feel kind of guilty when I've got so much work to do. But playing Best Fiends is guilt-free. It's an endless source of fun right on my phone that I can play anytime and anywhere. It's a match-3 puzzle game with literally thousands of levels and new content added all the time. I especially love playing Best Fiends after writing or recording. It's not just a mindless game to pass the time, but a satisfying challenge that helps me get out of my own head for a while. I've been playing Best Fiends for a year now, and I've made it to level 735. And there is a new challenge where if you collect screws, you get VIP time, which means you don't have to use energy for each level. Best Fiends is boredom's worst nightmare. With over 100 million downloads, players have found this 5-star rated game impossible to put down. We all love a good puzzle, and Best Fiends is here for us. With over 5,000 challenges and new ones added all the time, you'll find yourself saying, just one more level, every time you play. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Is there something bothering you? I know sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. You can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/southern. Despite Gary Hilton's capture, there was still no sign of Meredith. Law enforcement and Meredith's friends feared the worst. The party still searching for Meredith moved away from her abduction site and began searching Dawson Forest, 30 miles south of Blood Mountain and close to where Hilton had used a payphone to call his old boss. As the search for Meredith dragged on, investigators began to worry that if by some chance she was still alive, somewhere out there in the wilderness in the cold January night, she might not survive. This led the lead GBI agent, John Cagle, to determine that the best chance of recovering Meredith depended on Gary Hilton's cooperation. That Sunday, now 5 days since Meredith went missing, Agent Cagle consulted with Union County District Attorney Stan Gunter and Hilton's defense, and a deal was struck. In exchange for not seeking the death penalty, Gary Hilton would lead authorities to Meredith's body and plead guilty to one count of murder. In a taped confession to GBI investigators, Hilton explained how to find Meredith's body. He said that Meredith could be found in Dawson Forest and told them, quote, "The body will be approximately 40 yards, 120 feet out, covered by leaves and brush." He paused briefly before continuing, "The head will be missing." Up until this point, Gary Hilton had maintained a stony and cold demeanor. But once he began his confession, the floodgates opened in a sickening and cavalier manner. Hilton began telling the investigators about the final days of Meredith's life. According to Hilton, he had been hanging around Blood Mountain, stalking the woods to locate a victim when he spotted her. He said he only had $40 and, quote, "knew I would have to kill someone soon." He said he waited in the brush to ambush Meredith while wielding a knife as she was walking up the trail of Blood Mountain with Ella. As she was attacked, Meredith fought back and almost got the best of Hilton, first disarming him of his knife and then managing to force away the police baton. Hilton casually explained to law enforcement, "She was real quick with her hands and had no hesitation about grabbing weapons and everything. And not only that, she was hard to subdue. And she fought like hell, man." In her struggle to get away from Hilton, the pair tumbled off the trail and landed about 2 yards away from where the former cop, Seth Blankenship, would later find the police baton. Hilton said he was caught because of this fight with the small, ferocious Meredith. According to him, if it wasn't for the time it took to incapacitate Meredith, he would have had a chance to snag the water bottles and baton before they were found. By the time he had overpowered her, they were far from the actual trail. "She wouldn't stop," Hilton told investigators. "She wouldn't stop fighting and yelling at the same time, so I needed to both control her and silence her." According to NBC News, Hilton said he did that by punching her, blackening both of her eyes and possibly breaking her nose. He claimed the blows also broke his hand. He tied Meredith to a tree before returning to the area that she had wrestled away his police baton. The family, who had spotted the man and helped the retired cop search the trail, had been just 40 yards uphill from where Meredith was tied up. This would be among the many devastatingly near misses in finding Meredith alive. Hilton returned to Meredith, still tied to the tree, and threatened her, saying that he had a gun and would shoot her if she continued to fight him. Hilton then led her back down to the parking area where their vehicle sat, skirting the main trail and trying to avoid any hikers. After chaining her inside the back of his Astro van, Hilton retrieved Meredith's bank cards from her car that she had stashed underneath the driver's seat. Then Hilton drove the two of them from Blood Mountain to a bank in Blairsville, where he attempted to withdraw cash from Meredith's account. Meredith had given Hilton the wrong PIN. That's why he wasn't able to withdraw cash. He explained to the agents that Meredith insisted that she was giving him the correct PIN number and that the issue must be the type of bank they were at. Hilton then drove to a bank 50 miles south of where he had abducted her in Gainesville. After another failed attempt at withdrawing money, he drove them to a nearby wooded area and made camp for the night. God knows what Meredith must have been thinking and feeling as she was held captive. But she seemed to have kept her wits about her so far, continuing to give Hilton the wrong PIN number. Hilton, with Meredith still chained in the back of the van, traveled to Canton, Georgia, and again tried to use her bank cards. It was yet another failed effort. Throughout her abduction, Hilton lied to Meredith and told her he would eventually let her go unharmed. He callously admitted to investigators that he knew from the start he was going to kill her. Hilton even went through the charade of assuring Meredith that he would be releasing her soon while packing up their makeshift campsite and preparing to leave. It had been 3 days that Meredith had managed to stay alive, giving Hilton passcodes and trying to outsmart her captor. GBI agent Clay Bridges told NBC News, quote, "That's the one thing that broke my heart in this case. She was doing everything she was supposed to do to stay alive, and we didn't get there in time." Shortly after loading up his supplies, Hilton returned to the van with a tire iron and proceeded to bludgeon Meredith to death. In an attempt to keep Meredith from being identified, Hilton decapitated her and poured bleach all over her before dumping her body in Dawson Forest and covering her with leaves. It wasn't until later that GBI investigators would learn from Hilton that they had narrowly missed apprehending him before he murdered Meredith on January 4th. Michael Andrews, the driver of a lawn care truck, had gotten his truck stuck by a stream near where Hilton and Meredith were camped. Andrews walked toward Hilton, seated in his white van, to ask for help, but was met halfway by the man. Andrews eventually called the police to help get his truck unstuck, while Hilton hurriedly loaded his van and drove off with Meredith, still alive, and chained in the back. During his confession to the GBI, Hilton said he told Meredith at that moment, quote, "Hun, we gotta get out of here right now. The guy's stuck and the law's coming. He's called." Hilton then described how he willingly released Meredith's dog in the supermarket parking lot. He claimed to the GBI that he did know about Ella's identity chip, but according to his confession, when asked why he didn't kill the dog, he said he just couldn't do that. "I admit that I cannot stand having to report when someone's dog is killed, and I'm glad Ella was found alive." But the fact that Gary Hilton couldn't kill Meredith's dog, but had no problem brutally beating her to death and then decapitating her body, tells much about how disturbingly cold this man is. There had been so many near misses between members of law enforcement, the community, and Gary Hilton. Stephen Seegars, Meredith's boyfriend at the time of her murder, explained to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that, quote, "We never realized the scope of it. We kept checking the mountain, just checking the mountain." He added that after knowing how close they had been to Hilton, yet always seemingly one step behind, quote, "It was frustrating then, crushing now." Hilton was charged with capital murder, and a little over a month from Meredith's disappearance, he pled guilty in a Georgia courtroom. Meredith's mother, Susan, read a statement addressed to the court that said, quote, "I believe he is a bully and nothing more than a weak-minded coward who preys on others. I believe he considers himself a survivor. Well, anyone can see that he's a scared little man on the run." The state honored the deal they had struck with Gary Hilton, and he was sentenced to life in prison. According to the Dawson County News, Meredith's mother, Susan, was not sorry that the death penalty was taken off the table. She said in a 2008 quote, "That would have been an easy out for this menace. Let him stay alive and slowly rot." Unfortunately, Meredith Emerson was not Hilton's first victim. Throughout the search for Meredith, and then the subsequent search for Hilton, his name and picture were featured all over the regional news in Georgia and its surrounding states, including the area of Tallahassee, Florida. It was this focus of the media that allowed investigators in Florida to connect Hilton to a murder that took place just a month before Meredith's. On December 2nd of 2007, 46-year-old nurse and Sunday school teacher Cheryl Dunlap was reporting missing after she failed to show up to church and could not be reached by friends and family. Before she went missing, Cheryl had been spotted at several places on December 1st around Tallahassee. Her morning consisted of shopping in Tallahassee, cashing a check at her bank, and using a computer at a local library to email her son, who was in the Army. Cheryl was last seen that day at a popular sunny spot in Apalachicola National Forest called Leon Sinks. A couple had spotted her there, peacefully reading a book. On the evening of December 2nd, a man wearing a rubber mask used Cheryl's bank card to withdraw some cash from an ATM in Tallahassee. The card was used again on December 3rd and 4th, but by the time law enforcement were able to stake out the ATM, the man had stopped using the bank card and did not return to the ATM. Cheryl's car was found abandoned with a flat tire on the side of the Crawfordville Highway 2 days after her disappearance. And despite being treated as a crime scene, investigators were unable to find any useful evidence in the car. 2 weeks after Cheryl was reported missing, on December 16th, a group of hunters called the Leon County Sheriff's Office to report that they had found the decapitated body of a white woman in the Apalachicola National Forest. Her hands were also missing. Through DNA, the woman was confirmed to be Cheryl Dunlap. Her remains were so badly burned that law enforcement were unable to determine exactly how she had died. Despite this evidence, Cheryl's case had gone cold until investigators in Florida learned of the Meredith Emerson disappearance a month later. Meredith's case shared so many similarities to Cheryl's that Florida investigators got in contact with the GBI. Concerned citizens in Florida, after seeing the bolo for Hilton in Georgia, began calling in tips to the Florida investigators on Cheryl's case, confirming that they had seen him in the area around the same time that Cheryl had gone missing. One of those tips even placed Gary Hilton in the same area of the Apalachicola National Forest, where charred pieces of Cheryl's skull and hand bones were found. Analysts with Florida law enforcement spent weeks combing through the mess of Hilton's van in search of evidence to connect him to the Cheryl Dunlap case. IT detectives in the forensics lab were able to dig through memory cards and cameras that Hilton had in his van to try and recover deleted evidence. In total, 700 DNA samples from the van were analyzed. 4 years after Cheryl Dunlap's disappearance, Gary Hilton was finally put on trial for her murder. Prosecutors could not inform the jurors about Hilton's conviction for Meredith Emerson's murder, his creative and sadistic input in the Deadly Run film, or his connection to other crimes that had been uncovered. Despite these limitations, on April 21, 2011, Hilton was found guilty. Testimony revealed that Hilton had kept Cheryl alive for 2 days after her initial abduction. Although he had escaped the death penalty in Meredith Emerson's case, it was back on the table now in Florida. During sentencing, the jurors were now able to learn how Hilton had brutally murdered Meredith. Agents from the GBI took the stand to describe the horrific kidnapping and murder of Meredith Emerson, including playing pieces of Hilton's taped confession. Hilton's defense team argued that he was too mentally damaged to be truly culpable for his actions and therefore fought for a life sentence instead of the death penalty. One of his defense attorneys called in an expert to testify that a traumatic brain injury Hilton had experienced at the age of 10 was one of the mitigating factors that contributed to his mental instability. The defense also claimed that Hilton had endured a childhood of abuse, suffered from schizophrenia, and was well known to self-medicate with prescription drugs. The prosecution brought in their own clinical psychologist, who testified that Hilton was a psychopath and that his psychopathy alone was the factor that drove him to kill. The psychologist determined that Hilton was responsible for his own actions and aware of the difference between right and wrong. I've discussed the difference between legal insanity and medical insanity before, and that difference applies here, although Hilton didn't plead mental incompetence. But his psychopathy was brought up as a mitigating factor in sentencing. In the case of a psychopath like Hilton, he knew the difference between right and wrong. He just didn't care. Legal insanity would mean that Hilton didn't know right from wrong at the time of his crime. But he was a skilled predator of hiking trails. He planned the murders every time he ran out of money. There is no indication that there was any sexual motivation for his crimes. Hilton was just a cold-blooded drifter who killed for money. But he also seemed to enjoy the violence of killing, even if he couldn't bear to kill dogs. It took the jury just a little over an hour to unanimously recommend the death penalty. Gary Hilton sat expressionless, save for the tight set of his jaw, as he was sentenced to death. As Hilton's information was shared across news stations and regions in the South, investigators in yet another murder case, this time in North Carolina, found a connection to Hilton, the murder of an elderly married couple, Jack and Irene Bryant, near the Pisgah National Forest. Jack and Irene were true nature lovers that had been married for 58 years. The two had met in Montana after attending college. Jack worked as a lawyer, while Irene was one of the first female veterinarians in the state. For a time, Irene even owned her own practice in New York before closing up shop to raise her children, three boys and one girl. Later in life, Jack completed hiking the over 2,000-mile-long Appalachian Trail. After retirement and in between traveling the world, Jack volunteered his legal services in his free time as his wife tended to her garden at their home. The couple shared a passion for the outdoors and enjoyed hiking together, still tackling adventures into their 80s. On August 21st, 2007, 84-year-old Irene and Jack, just shy of his 80th birthday, set out from their home to hike in the Pisgah National Forest. They were only 20 miles from their home when they encountered Gary Hilton. The couple had been missing for 3 weeks when Irene's body was located on Yellow Gap Road, barely covered with brush and twigs, still within the Pisgah National Forest. There was no sign of her husband. Irene's autopsy would later reveal that she had been killed by blunt force trauma to her head, and her right forearm had also been severed. The day following Irene's murder, her ATM card was used in Ducktown, Tennessee. An amount of $300 was withdrawn. Jack's skeletal remains were later found by hunters within the Nantahala National Forest in Macon County, North Carolina. It was later determined that he had died as the result of a gunshot to the head from a .22 Magnum. After Gary Hilton's conviction and death sentencing in Florida for the murder of Cheryl Dunlap, he was transferred to North Carolina, where he was indicted for the murders of Jack and Irene Bryant. In March 2012, Hilton pled guilty to murdering the couple, while also pleading guilty to robbery, kidnapping, and firearms offenses. On April 25, 2013, Hilton was sentenced to four life sentences for the kidnapping and murder of Jack and Irene, 5 years after the couple had been murdered. He received an additional 15 years in prison for the related robbery charge. In February of 2010, 2 years after Meredith's death, Fred Rosen, the true crime writer, who would later write a book about Gary Hilton's life and murders, was working for the porn magazine Hustler. Rosen filed an open records request for photos of Meredith's crime scene and autopsy, along with the tapes of Hilton's confession and the results of Meredith's rape kit, all for a story he was writing for Hustler. Meredith's family filed a suit against the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to temporarily keep the photos from being released. Before DeKalb Superior Court Judge Daniel Kersey officially barred Rosen and the magazine from accessing the photos. After this, the Georgia House Governmental Affairs Committee unanimously passed the Meredith Emerson Memorial Privacy Act. The act prevents crime scene photos from being publicly released or disseminated if the images include a victim appearing, quote, nude, bruised, bloodied, or in a broken state with open wounds, a state of dismemberment, or decapitation. While criticized by First Amendment scholars, the bill does allow law enforcement, lawyers, and accredited journalists access to the photos at the GBI headquarters. But making copies is not allowed. As someone who researches and writes about true crime, I have looked at crime scene and autopsy photos. I don't shy away from them, and I don't get nightmares. I'm not sure what that means, except maybe I am desensitized. And I would be lying if I said seeing those photos didn't affect my understanding of the crime and how I presented it on my show. But I respect victims and their families, and would never publish photographs I was given access to. I've seen crime scene photos in numerous true crime novels, It is common, especially with serial killers. But I do believe we have reached an era where that access should be limited. As one of the investigators in Meredith Emerson's case put it, she is not here to consent to those photos being published. And her parents definitely objected, wanting to preserve her dignity in death. Following the kidnapping and murder of her friend, Meredith's roommate, Julia Karen Bauer, started the organization Right to Hike, which serves to educate hikers on safety measures while hiking. The Georgia-based organization hosts hikes and other fundraisers to contribute to the different causes that were close to Meredith's heart. Ella, Meredith's rescue dog, went to live with her parents. After Gary Hilton's arrest in Meredith's case and subsequent convictions, law enforcement officials across the South have reevaluated their cold case and missing person files to see if any line up with Hilton's travels throughout different national forests. Hilton, dubbed the National Forest Serial Killer, is a person of interest in at least one other case. In 2005, 26-year-old Rosanna Milani disappeared while vacationing near the National Forest in North Carolina. Though her body has never been found, on the day Rosanna went missing, she was seen purchasing a sleeping bag with a man who matched Hilton's description. Many investigators over the years have said that it would be unusual for Hilton's victim count to be so low. He was a confident, skilled killer, and most serial killers don't begin that late in life. Perhaps as the advancements in DNA continue, more victims who can be tied to Hilton will be identified. But for now, we just can't be sure. And Hilton has not, to my knowledge, offered to confess to other murders to try and save his own life. But he did appeal his death sentence in the state of Florida, citing that his defense team could not efficiently represent him due to their high case turnover and lack of communication, along with a poor strategy. The average stay on Florida's death row is 12 and a half years, and Hilton is still awaiting his execution date. Now 73 years old, Hilton has attempted several appeals, the most recent of which took place in September of 2020. The 12-and-a-half-year average will be up in a couple of years. At his age, he could be dead by then anyway, but if he's not, Florida is not known for waiting around too long. That's why so many people were incredulous that serial killer Ted Bundy fled to Florida of all states. If Gary Hilton doesn't die of natural causes, the state of Florida will execute him soon. In his taped confession with the GBI, Gary Hilton bragged to investigators, quote, "I'm a philosopher, I'm a soldier, I'm a scientist, and I'm an artist. My art is my life, and my art is weird." Gary Hilton is a predator who stalked and hunted his victims in the environment that they felt most at home, in the tranquility and beauty of our national parks. He preyed on his victims' love of nature and brutally took their lives for measly amounts of money and his own sick pleasure. Without his arrest and conviction in Meredith's case, law enforcement in Florida and North Carolina may have never put together the missing pieces in the cases of Jack and Irene Bryant and Cheryl Dunlap, and their families might still be wondering what monster had ended their lives. Many of the stories that I came across while researching this case described Meredith Emerson's strength and fighting skills, noting that she was able to overpower her killer several times before he finally gained control. While it's important to share about Meredith's moxie and grit, I think it's even more important to acknowledge that her fight was not a failure. 24-year-old, animal-loving, compassionate, and yet fierce Meredith Emerson almost took down a crazed serial killer while battling for her life. Ultimately, her training in martial arts and self-defense skills were not enough to save her own life, but her strength and savvy helped to lead to the capture of her killer, helping to solve other murders, and certainly preventing further innocent blood loss on these desolate but beautiful Appalachian mountains. Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Hannah Newcomb, with additional research, writing, and editing by me. The audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. If you're not already a member, come join my Facebook group. While we do discuss crime, we also share memes and have a lot of laughs. We worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, and our motto is, no shit asses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept case suggestions on social media private messages, but please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.